Welcome to the music show Deviations on Radio Ara in Luxembourg. This show, we look at bands from the indie, rock and punk scene that don't get the attention they deserve in the mainstream media. Today, I'm on the phone with Billy McCarthy, the founder, singer, songwriter and guitarist of the band Augustines from New York. Hello, Billy McCarthy. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's nice to talk to you, man.
I'm very glad that you found the time to chat with me a little and give the listeners of our show the opportunity to get to know you, your musical work, and especially your former band, Augustines.
Yeah.
When I play Augustines songs to my friends, I often get the reaction, hey, that sounds good, but it sounds a little bit like the early U2. Personally, I don't necessarily compare Augustines with this band. Now, if you met someone and had to describe Augustines' band to them in a few sentences, what would you say?
Oh, I would say a hardworking indie rock band with an emphasis on live music.
Which bands or singers would you say are your biggest musical influences?
Oh, so many. A lot of it's not really rock and roll. A lot of like people from the past, a lot of Spanish singers, jazz singers, Motown singers. Those people influenced me a lot.
The music of the band Augustines was unique, but what set you apart from other great bands was, if I may say so, your personal story, which is one of the essential basic ingredients of your songs. Now, in his bestseller, Angler's Ashes, Frank McCourt writes, "When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Your childhood was also very difficult. You grew up without your biological father and your mother was a drug addict and schizophrenic. In addition, you had a brother who was only a few years younger than you. And not only did you have to look after him, you were also a kind of a father replacement for him. You spent your youth in foster families until you were told at the age of 19 that your mother had committed suicide. That is heavy stuff for a young person. Can you remember moments in your childhood when you were happy?"
That's a great question. I think about that sometimes because I think just being a child is a new experience. There's so many things that are new and innocent. And I think that as I've gotten older, I realize that when people have their innocence disrupted, if it's interrupted, their innocence, a lot of times people spend the rest of their lives sort of responding to that. And I see this story quite a bit as I've gotten older. And I think that I had my sensory, the wind, the ocean, the sun, children, food, sports, they were all normal feelings. But I think my relationship with adults was very complicated because I saw maybe the worst of adults very early. So my understanding of life and the relationship with adults was always a challenge for me.
Now, as an adult, are you happy today?
I am. I'm concerned quite a bit about the technological world that we're in now. I'm a bit concerned about that. I struggle with being an artist is a pretty strange choice. And it's getting more difficult, our music being free on Spotify is a major problem. But it's not an easy path, definitely.
You founded the band Augustines with Eric Sanderson in 2010 after disbanding the band Pela. This show now is mainly about Augustines, but we have to talk very briefly about Pela, as that was actually the backstory of Augustines. So you, Eric, and two other musicians were on the road with Pela for 8 years and not without success. You played a lot of concerts and even had an official album, Anytown Graffiti, released. You were actually in the process of producing a second album. Is that correct so far?
Yeah, that's correct.
Then something terrible happened. Your brother, who was, just like your mother, known to be schizophrenic and drug addict, should have been sent to a psychiatric institution where mentally ill people were cared for. Instead, he spent 5 years in solitary confinement in a Californian prison where he ultimately took his own life. Can I say that this threw you off track and was the main reason why you couldn't continue with the Pillar Project anymore?
Yeah, I think in English we have a saying, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was something not related to music, but I think the size and the weight of that experience maybe changed some things, because I mean, obviously, it's mortality is a difficult thing to understand or think about when you're out drinking whiskey at the pubs and playing rock and roll shows. It's not something you're thinking about a lot, but I think it was such a defeating experience for me, because two things that are very complicated and complex things are mental illness is one, and two, prison. And I think in Western society, I think when we see a crime, you know, we think, you know, go to prison. Like, and then if they go to prison, it's sort of over for our consciousness. We don't think about their life anymore. We don't think about their existence. And we don't, you know, we're just sort of happy that justice has happened, and we don't, like, maybe the danger is gone from society. It's very difficult about prison is that these people are alive, you know, and they have a whole life, you know, to live. So I think my brother went to prison at, I'd say maybe 25 years old, and for life, you know. And the problem is, because I didn't have any family, I was like managing his situation with his, I guess his lawyer, legal people. And he never went to trial. He never talked to a judge. He was never sentenced to life in prison, but I was told very quickly that he will never get out. And I was thinking, you know, do you know that he has mental illness? Yes, he's schizophrenic. And so now when we have these two things, mental illness and then the prison, the justice system crossing and connecting, we have a very difficult thing to process for a person like me. I think I was working at a pub, you know. I didn't have any education about the American justice system.
And you were young as well, then? You were very young as well. That's not to be forgotten. In 2011, you released under band name We Are Augustines a new album called Rise, Ye Sunken Ships. There are also pieces on it that were still created during Pillar's time.
Yeah.
Did forming the new band help you come to terms with the cruel chapter of James' death?
Yes. It's funny because I felt like, you know, maybe 1.5, 2 years was a long time to be, you know, grieving the fact that somebody died and in such a sad way. And I was so happy to start performing again. And recently, Augustine's drummer, Rob Ballen, we were talking about music, and he was saying, you know, it was really too early for you to be in front of people, you know, and having all this business stuff and the band. It was very early, maybe too early, you know. And I was thinking, God, I never thought about that. But it really was less than 2 years, you know, before I was touring again. So maybe probably needed some therapy. It probably would have been good to talk to some professionals. And I never did, you know. So I think performing live music and singing, something really special happened. And what was special is that what's very different about mental illness compared to a regular illness or normal illness is that mental illness isn't really talked about. You know, very similar to like abuse, like talk about childhood abuse very much, or sexual abuse or mental illness. We just don't really talk about it. But the problem is that It's everywhere. It's generally in every family, I think, you know. And so when I was performing after the shows, you know, I was talking to people, and so many people were telling me, my father is mentally ill, or my sister's husband, you know, is bipolar. And like, a lot of people were telling me this, you know, 12 years ago. And it really wasn't. Now we have Chris Cornell, Robin Williams. We've got so many different people, Scott Hutchison, these people who have committed suicide because they're mentally ill. But I think in 2012, like, people really weren't talking about it as much as they are now. So I was finding out, like, whoa, this is everywhere, every country. It's, you know, it's very real.
Yeah, but it's like a stigma. It's nobody wants, yes, to talk about it. It's really, you better look, yes, healthy and cool and sexy.
Yeah.
In the song Book of James, you refer, and that's how I interpret it, directly to your last encounter with your brother, how you found him, and what you felt about it. And you sing, he stood there in his shoes, unable to move. Kid, I drove all night here to tell you I love you. And here lies my green eyes, rolled back in my head, but they're alive. And all these words can all get spoken. Well, I know we tried, and you're forgiven. You're forgiven. Every time I hear this, I start crying.
Yeah.
How much imagination is in your texts, and how much of it have you actually experienced?
I've experienced all of it. It's a very real song. It's a strange thing, you know, because the short story is that I was in this band. We were touring, but we didn't have any support, so we still had jobs, you know, and playing music is, it's challenging, because when you leave maybe for 3 or 4 weeks touring, when you come back, you have not worked for 1 month, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have money problems.
Yeah.
And so there was just always, it just was so difficult doing this Pela band, and I really felt like Pela was going to end, you know, and because it just wasn't possible to keep going like this. And so I had never written about my brother before, and the whole entire time I was in Pela, my brother was in prison. So I think I just decided, well, if it's going to end, then I'm going to be honest, because I want to have something for my family. I want something for my brother. I want him to hear this, that he's not alone, and that, you know, I'm thinking of him. So I started writing about it, thinking, I don't really care what happens if, you know, if the band ends, then at least I have something for my family. And so I started writing about it, and then my brother died, and then the band ended, and I'm sitting here, and I have all this music, and the only thing that isn't on the record really is the conclusion, which is that the protagonist, the character of the story, is he dies. And I wrote this song, you know, one night. I was in a flat in New York, and there was an empty apartment in the top floor of the building, and I took some beer, and I took a piece of paper and a guitar, and I went up into this empty apartment into a closet, and I just sat in the closet and drank and wrote this song. And then, you know, I started playing it. I made a recording of it, and I showed it to Eric, and it was, you know, we had both agreed that the band was over, you know. And then it started becoming very sad to us that we had this record that no one would ever hear. And what I wanted to do was to finish this song, because I thought it would complete the record. And we started working on the song, and then it really started feeling like, wow, I think this is an important subject for the public to hear about. You know, I think this is real, and I think we should talk about it, you know. So then it was like, okay, let's let's finish the record. And then we finished the record. Then it was like, maybe we should go on one tour, just two of us. And then it was like, okay, well, let's not be Pela. What's a good name for the band? And my brother and I are born in August. And we have the same birthday.
Yeah, 15th.
So I was thinking, well, let's change the name to Augustines. And then we were thinking, okay, well, maybe we should get a drummer. And then we asked Pela's drummer. He said he couldn't do it anymore. But he had a person in his building that played drums. The guy was from England. And we met him, and then we became Augustines.
And just to complete also, I think Eric's birthday is just a day after yours in the calendar.
Yeah, exactly.
And to just conclude also the explanation to our listeners about Augustines, your brother also died in the month of August, and Pela broke up in August, right? So the name Augustines really has a meaning.
Yes.
In 2014, you released then a new album, simply called Augustines. And while the first album was to a great extent about your younger brother and your feelings associated with it, one gets the impression that with the second album you have outgrown your problems and have become much more mature. The sound is also more rocking than before. Was music a way to cope with your grief, or did the problems caused by the music business only burden you more?
Well, there's sort of two different parts of the human experience. One is sort of mental, like logistic, you know, what was happening was that we were playing bigger shows very quickly. And, you know, we really didn't have a lot of experience or time as Augustines. Like, I think we started touring like immediately. So usually when a band starts, they're kind of a local band for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you start making some recordings and it's feeling good. Then you try to tour. And then maybe you get a record contract or something. But it happened for us very differently. We started touring. And basically the crowd in the rooms were getting bigger. And, you know, that I had a lot of mental things to kind of logistics to think about. And I think that the second record... Yes, like my mission was accomplished. I think what was very important for me was that I felt like if I didn't do Rising Sunken Ships, that my brother would be forgotten. He didn't have a funeral. He was forgotten about, you know, and I felt like if I didn't put this record out, his story would never be told. So that was accomplished in Rise. So I felt mature. I felt it was good for my heart. I felt a lot better. And then I got to do a record, the second record, properly, you know, with like a producer. And I didn't have to work. I was doing music professionally. So there was a lot of relief for the second record.
In a song, Now You're Free, you sing, let go of all your ghosts, or more will come around. Was that still about your brother, James, or was it already more about you? And have you chased away your ghosts by now?
I think it was more about me. It was strange. I think it was a strange time because, I didn't plan on living in New York. I lived there for 20 years. I lived there almost half my life. So I really always wanted to go back home to where I'm from in California. And I think that when I started having success, I realized that I couldn't, you know, go back home, that this was my life now. And it's, in some ways, it's almost easier to have a dream because it's a dream. And then the actual reality of your dream coming true, there's a lot of things that happen inside of you, a lot of complex things. And I think that my ghosts, you know, maybe my pain and maybe my fear and maybe those, you know, kind of deeper things that I just really wanted to be well. I wanted to be happy and balanced. And, you know, I was sort of healing and like in a tour bus. I was traveling and healing. It's a difficult concept, but I think when I stopped touring, we played 250 shows our first year.
Wow.
As Augustines. Yeah. So it was getting so intense that, like, we were playing 5 or 6 nights a week. So, you know, 3 nights, 1 day off, 4 nights, 1 day off, 3 nights. And so I think me, when it stopped, I was like, whoa, okay, where do I live? Who am I? Mm-hmm. Am I the same person? Am I, you know, I'm playing in these different countries. Like, this is a lot, you know, it's a lot to process.
Can I say that your emotional journey reached a turning point with the second album and that you found some of your inner peace?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, we're all, you know, we're all working on ourselves always, I hope. I mean, but I think for me, yeah, I was peaceful because finally, like I said, the story of my family was now for the public, like, and I accomplished my mission. So I did have peace. I would say definitely. We always have difficulty with reconciliation of where we come from, but mm-hmm. I felt proud that I got to go, you know, on television and tell my story. You know, I'm playing, you know, and these heroes, I was playing, like, it was very crazy, man. Like,
absolutely.
Playing with, I remember we opened for The Cure, and I remember, like, wow, man, I used to listen to The Cure when I was like 12.
So your childhood 14. Heroes.
Yeah, heroes. So this was like, it felt amazing.
Yeah, I can tell you, you have plenty of things to be proud of. There seem to have been a few people in the course of your career that you would have better not be meeting. Apparently, you never managed to earn enough money with your music, and you were repeatedly given bad advice. Your colleague Eric Sanderson once said that for a while you were playing sold-out venues all over the country, but you guys barely had the money to pay your own way there. Why did you always end up with the wrong people?
That's a really fantastic question, Frederick. I would say, you know, I think the music business, I don't want to sound dramatic, but the truth of it is that the music business had a very big decade in the 90s. And before that, the 80s and the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, these were all very successful decades of music. And if you think about rock and roll is really only like 60 years old, right? You know, from the 50s. Yeah, like 60, 70 years old. The thing with rock and roll is it's actually pretty expensive to make. It's expensive to tour. It's the instruments are expensive. And I think that what was happening, man, is through the 90s, rock and roll was the biggest music in the world. And then we go into the 2000s and something very important happened, the internet. I think when the internet started, you know, we had this symposium, this amazing different sort of dimension we could all go in, and, you know, we're there's websites and there's now social media and all these things are happening. But I think another thing that really happened that's very important to talk about is that the ability to do file sharing. In the beginning, mm-hmm. it was Napster and file sharing.
Yep.
And after Napster and file sharing, you know, Metallica was in court with them. Mm-hmm. It was a big thing in the early 2000s.
Yep.
And then by the mid-2000s, the record labels actually were starting to get scared and their contracts started getting smaller, right? And so in the middle of the 2000s to the end of the decade, basically the music business started shifting dramatically. Rock and roll was actually an expensive genre to support for record labels. And then with the rise of social media happening, you know, first MySpace or Friendster, MySpace, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So we started this journey, and I think that Apple Music came out, iTunes, and they're all trying to figure out how to protect their assets, which are their artists and their recordings. And so what happens is very slowly, the personnel and the staff of record labels, they're starting to get smaller. People are being fired. They're trying to figure out how to keep this industry thriving and profitable. And we, you know, it was great in the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, there was this very strong independent music, indie labels. Indie was short for independent. And so we come to like the end of the 2000s, which is where Augustine starts. And there's a major problem. The money is gone. So when the money's gone, that means good lawyers are gone. Good management is gone. Good labels are gone, because each one of these labels is sort of an ecosystem of designers, lawyers, managers, tour managers, sound engineers. Like, in each label has this little ecosystem to it. When a label closes, it goes bankrupt, that ecosystem starts running looking for work. So they're it really got confusing. And so the reason that I think that we kept receiving bad advice is because the whole industry started looking at itself, like, where's the money? Where do we go to keep our job? And so, you know, bigger artists, say The Strokes or, you know, Interpol, they were okay. And the bottom artists that were playing locally for 100 people, you know, they were okay. It was the middle. That was the competitive, really dangerous place. And, you know, if you get a contract and you're talking to a manager who's managing now three times more bands than they ever had to just to survive, they don't have time for you. And so when you go to a lawyer, they're not being paid by a record label. They're not being paid, you know, by a big successful band. They're being paid what they can get. So their performance is much lower. And basically, that's what happened. The record business was starting to fall apart. And so then we get to now. And remember when I was saying rock and roll is expensive? If you look at the rise of hip hop, this music is very affordable. It's a laptop and a DJ and an MC. Easy. If you look at Lizzo, if you look at God, I mean, there's so many hip hop artists. Mm-hmm. Run the Jewels. This is maybe some dancers and a person on a microphone. There's no drummer. There's no guitar player. It's very cheap to make this music because you could do it on a laptop, and then you could perform it and tour it with just two or three people. So basically, as we're here now in 2024, the industry is really, it's really bad now, because I think that what's happened is that Spotify started in 2015, and they made the music free on Spotify. And because they're a Swedish company, in international law, a lot of like countries could not take them to court. And so by the time the record industry, which was already in a bad situation, like saw what was happening, what they started saying is social media is the future. Social media is the future. So what's happened is hip hop is the number one music in the world. It's at the top of the charts. People are making it on laptops for very cheap. The quality has gone down. Yeah. And record labels are looking at artists saying, you do the work. You get your social media numbers big, which has nothing to do with music, right? And then we look at all of this, and the artists are not receiving money for their work because of Spotify and social media. So we've got an industry that's totally not dying. I think it's actually dead. That's why we got bad advice, is that the era the era that we were in was a very tragic era for the business of music. And the last and most important thing is that when we started listening to music for free, what the public didn't realize is that they might think they're getting a free CD or a free album. What they did is they made all of the business people and the record labels, they scared the money away. So when they started getting it for free, all the business people left. And what happens is the label has no more investment to give the artist to make a record. So the quality of the records are going down. The lifespan of an artist is going to be two records maximum, maybe three. And then your band is over because it's not sustainable. So when we listen to music for free or we take people's art and we listen to it on an app and we think that it's not hurting anybody, what it's done is it scared all of the ecosystem, all the people that used to invest, they ran away.
In the first album, Rise Your Sunken Ships, you deal with social problems of the lower classes in the USA, the ailing health system, and of course the death of your brother. The second album was already much more optimistic, although it wasn't entirely free of sadness either. But it is more about hope, freedom, self-discovery. And then in 2016, the third Augustine's album, entitled This Is Your Life, was released. With it, you became much more rocking and also faster. Is it fair to say that the three albums of Augustine's built on each other, both in terms of the music and the lyrics?
Yeah, I would say that's correct.
Your concerts were absolutely thrilling, and it was particularly impressive, for me at least, when you descended into the audience at the end and then continued playing in the middle of the crowd. If you were to go back to 2010 with your current experience, what would you do differently then?
It's difficult, man. That's a difficult question because I really don't think that there's anything we could do. It was an interesting time because I was we were playing in different countries, and I remember we were playing in the UK, and they were playing our music at the Manchester United Stadium, during the matches, right? Yeah. So that was happening. So we're on the radio, on BBC, we're on Flux FM in Germany, we're on RTE in Ireland. We're opening for Florence and the Machine or really big bands. We're playing festivals constantly. So that should be enough to survive. But like I said, my understanding of the whole entire landscape of the music industry is that if you have investment leave the industry, nothing is sustainable for very long. And I think when I look back, I think about it a lot, what could we have done differently? I don't think we could have done very much, to be honest. I think, if we look at, fossil fuels, and then we look at electric cars, Tesla, right? And we see Tesla growing. They don't even have promotion. They're just a success story. And then you look at Twitter, right? Also Elon Musk, and this company is dying. It's over. Nobody takes it seriously. It's when we look at how fast this happened, where the ability to have an electric vehicle and that changing the entire landscape of an industry. And then we see Twitter actually had cultural relevance, and the fact that that's now just a joke, these are industries weird, turning very quickly. And I think that the thing that's difficult for me is that when I look back at what we could have done, I think we were brave. We worked really hard, and we did better than anybody that I made it farther than probably any musician that I ever played with. And it's and still the reputation is that I had bad advice, and there's a sort of a tragic feeling. And actually, I think anybody who started in 2011, 12, 13, they're probably not around anymore.
Except maybe a few very big ones. When I look at the websites of the three former Augustine's members, I get the impression that your colleagues, Eric Sanderson, who played several instruments in the band, and your drummer, Rob Allen, are now mainly active behind the scenes in the studios.
Yeah.
And I also noticed that both of them make on their websites a strong reference on Augustine's. So it seems to me that none of you can still cope with the fact that this great band no longer exists.
Yeah.
Why don't you just forget the past and any problems that you had with the band or with the business, and give it a second try and reunite? I think there are so many musical masterpieces that you could still create, and so many souls you would be able to reach. You never thought of reuniting?
I'm thinking about it right now, to be honest with you. I've been writing a record since May, and it's pretty incredible, if I'm honest. It's an Augustine's record, and I'm actually going to New York City to record with Augustine's in 2 weeks.
Wow, is this true?
Yeah, this is true.
This is fantastic.
Now, it's incredible, but we've got a very familiar situation. What do we do with this record? Where do we go? What can we, you know what I mean? We can make a record that's possible. Is it possible to do a band again? And, what is the reality of that? For me, I always, I make music because I have to, and, I don't think about the logistics of, the next, it's just really the art, the making, the creativity for me, right?
Mm-hmm. But somebody has to think about the logistics.
That's it. So if I'm honest with you, I have written an Augustine's record, and I'm going to record it in a couple of weeks with Peter Kadis. And I'm looking at the situation, and I'm honestly, I don't know the answer. I make music and I make art because I like my life better when I do that. About how to make it a business, I don't know, man. I don't know what will happen. I just know that I need to make this record.
Yeah, but let's hope that you will find this time people who better, support you, and that this time you will be able to make a living out of that. And I think it is not a lack of creativity from your side or from you and your colleague's side. It is. So let's. I'm really looking forward to hear what goes next. Then.
Thank you.
Now, changing the topic a little bit, you are a citizen of the United States of America.
Yes, sir.
A country that I really like very much. And the last time I was there was 2 years ago. I really enjoyed it. But we Europeans are also afraid of the USA. Mm. Especially now, many, many people are very worried about the elections that will take place in November.
Yeah.
What is your opinion on this matter? Does it concern you?
In the new record, I've been writing a bit about that, actually. Last November, I was visiting my sister in California, and I went to the grocery store to get some food, and I had somebody put a gun up to my head. And to be honest with you, I've had four guns put up to my head in my life. And, I'm sick of it. I'm scared by America too. I've lost my whole family has been through hell in America, and it's very upsetting, and I don't think I can live in a place that guns are legal like this. When I'm there, I can't believe it. Like, I can't believe that there's school shootings. I can't believe the reality of what's happened to this country. And I think, you know, it's funny because we're watching Gaza and Israel right now, very painful experience to watch this. But something actually has happened during this situation, and that people are talking about propaganda. And, you know, Americans, I don't think we really think about propaganda very much. It's not something that we're, you know, we think a lot about. But I have to say, you know, I think there is propaganda in America because, you know, Americans were sort of brainwashed when we're children that we're the greatest country in the world. And I think that's very cool to be proud. But unfortunately, what it does is it creates a mentality that you don't have to leave, you don't have to look for anything, you don't have to try, because you're living in the best place that it's possible to live in. And that's just not true. Whenever I see people say, you know, even in New York City, New York City is the greatest city in the world. It's such an American statement to say you're the greatest of anything. It reminds me of ancient Rome. It's just a very egotistical, narcissistic way to look at the world. And I don't agree with it. And I frankly don't want to be around it anymore. And when I go home, I live in Europe now, but when I go home, I'm shocked, you know, that this is where we've come to as a people. I understand it's 330 million people. I understand that education, I think half the country is finished college, but the reality is it creates poverty. It creates a lot of things. And again, I had a gun. I could have died last November, you know. The police came. They arrested the guy. It was horrible, man. And you know what? When I looked at the guy getting arrested, you know what? What was happening for me, I felt bad for him. I felt empathy, like, wow, you grew up in a country, in a landscape, in a mentality that this is acceptable. And if I go to Heidelberg, Germany, or I go to Luxembourg or Switzerland, or I go to Scotland or Italy or Australia, Canada, like, this isn't acceptable. And I think Donald Trump, you know, in my opinion, I don't think that people really like Donald Trump. I think that Donald Trump is a protest. A conservative way of thinking about our rights, our church, our abortion, our, you know, it's constantly like this old way, this old mentality. And they chose Donald Trump to say, fuck you. That's why we're choosing this rich guy from New York City. Fuck you. And the truth is I understand people not having education because I lived in that way when I was young. I understand why they're angry, but if we just say, no, like, we're not going to be professional, we're going to ridicule, mock, insult people politically, this is when we become a ghetto. This is when we lose any professionalism, we lose our integrity and our respect for others and respect for ourselves when we start acting like a mafioso. It's ridiculous. I think it's very sad to say this, but maybe we have to keep, you know, we have to keep repeating this sad reality until we learn. You know, like I'm living in Ireland now, and there's a lot of anti-American feelings here, and I understand. America's supplying Israel with weapons. It's people are angry. But what I always tell people is, you know, we can't decide on millions of people that we just make a decision about them, because it's not possible. For me, if I look at Russia and say Russians are bad because they're invading Ukraine, that's too easy. It's just too easy to look at millions of people and say, I don't like you. It's not even intelligent. It's not possible to know that those millions of people. So that's the first thing, that if people are angry or frustrated, I understand fatigue and I understand concern and fear. I understand. But if you really think about it, America is just land. The actual land of America is beautiful. But I think the concept of this place where people have unalienable rights and they have, you know, they have these rights that were promised to them in, you know, made 400 years ago during slavery. It's like, it's not working anymore. It doesn't work anymore. So if we refuse to change, we're going to stay here. So maybe this terrible thing that we're watching is necessary, just like Germany. You know, in the 1940s, it was like this: Germany had to sort of die for it to change. And lastly, when we look at the United States, we have to understand, I always tell people this when I'm traveling, the thing that we have to understand is that Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska, and Miami, Florida are two different planets, but they're the same country. So if we see, you know, America internally fighting, it's because our strength is our size and our diversity. We create hip-hop, rock and roll, playwrights, authors, education, all kind of amazing scientific discoveries. But that's also our weakness, is that we're too big to really become unified. And I think this is the problem that we're having.
Let's shift back a little bit to music. Since the breakup of Augustine's, you've been touring alone, and your music is now a little bit closer to folk than it used to be to rock. I think that's also because, as a solo artist, you can't build a soundscape like a whole band. But can you make a decent living from your art today, or do you still feel the financial pressure you were under as a band?
I can. I changed everything. I basically looked at the industry dying and I said, okay, well, I'm going to try a subscription model. So in 2017, I started with Patreon. Mm-hmm. I was one of the very early people doing that. And then the second thing is I started looking at Spotify and I said, well, I'm not going to give my music to them because they're not treating us right. So I'll give my music to people who... we have a relationship. You treat me right, I'll treat you right, and let's celebrate expression and music. So I haven't given my solo work to Spotify, so I stopped that, and I went very independent, and I work with people directly. And another thing, I looked at the tours in Europe now, they are taking 40% of merchandise from the band. So if you play a show, the club wants to take 40% of your t-shirts for that night, which is crazy. So I started looking at sustainability of touring, and I just said, okay, I'm going to play pop-up shows. And so for the last 7 years, I've been flying Australia, Canada, Mexico, Vietnam, Thailand, Spain, Italy, Germany, Britain, Ireland. I've been flying all over the world, Cambodia, performing, but just very quietly, just on a direct basis, that if people want me to play, we make a budget and I fly out and I perform for them. And I've gone around the industry, and in that way, I have made a living. I've survived. But you're right, to do a big rock and roll show, it needs to have a big rock and roll club or a big rock and roll room. I am not able to do that with a subscription model. So I'm writing this Augustine's record like, I don't know how to do this again, but this is the type of music that I want to write right now. So I have to figure that out, man.
You mentioned the many countries you've been traveling to making music. What impressed you most on your travels?
Wow. I mean, it's always changing. I'm lucky because I am from the West, And when I go to countries, generally, I'm okay. I was maybe 2 months ago in Turkey, and I felt like a different energy there, and I've felt that sometimes. But generally, I'm usually pretty safe. There's so much. I mean, Vietnam, looking at a country that has recovered from gone through in its past. I've been to Romania, the Eastern Europe. There's so much to be learned about the fall of communism. I live in Ireland, seeing colonialism and the difficult relationship with the Irish in Northern Ireland and Britain. Been in Britain and seeing the challenges of immigration and illegal immigration in Britain and Brexit and reform and Tories and all of it. I've seen Canada and the Northern Territories and indigenous towns and villages and the complicated relationship between the stipend that First Nation and Indigenous people receive from the government, and how that feels for Australians and Canadians to have this relationship that they have made big mistakes, but it wasn't them, it was their great grandfathers.
And
I've
still.
played in the American South. I've played in the North. I've seen kind of everything you can see. I think the biggest thing, what it's given me, is just really, I really have always been a heart-led person. Like I lead with my heart. I don't always know the logistics, how I'm going to make everything a reality, but I try to go by my heart. And what I've learned from the world is just empathy. I see Republicans, I really feel for them. I see the right in Germany. For some crazy reason, this is happening. I see France. I see what's going on. I usually the fundamental center, the foundation of these movements culturally and politically are generally fear. And my girlfriend, who's Irish, she just went skiing, and she was in Switzerland, and she's been working there. And she went skiing for like the second time in her life, and she had to take some lessons. And the instructor was teaching this class about how to ski. And the instructor said, very typically, children learn within a couple of hours, and it's difficult for adults. And she asked, my girlfriend asked, like, why is that? Why does it take adults so long to learn? And she said, fear, the relationship with fear. So I think fear is debilitating. I think that, I mean, I don't know how people can be afraid of gay or trans people in this modern era, abortion, all these things. It's just people being afraid, man. And I don't think being told that there's a heaven and hell and a God and Christianity helped anything. I think that religion and, conservatism has been a very, they've been a great partners. I live in Ireland, so it's like I've seen what it's done to people. And, I think generally fear is very powerful stuff, man. The only thing you can do to fight it is empathy. That's my weapon, is empathy.
But if I just may answer to that, as
Yes.
religion, let's say, was built on fear, but
Yes.
if you look back at the origins of the religion, that was never the purpose. Because
No,
the
no.
purpose was love and understanding and being kind and being generous with others. That was the main idea of when the religions were built, I would say. And it was
Yeah.
human who made out of it over the centuries and our institutions built on power. And in the end, there wasn't any difference anymore between a religion and a state. Some religions were even more cruel than states have ever
Yes.
been.
Definitely. I've been to the Middle East. I've been to Jerusalem. I've been to Israel. And you're right. Like, I mean, I'm not Christian, but I think the concept of this mysterious man named Jesus that lived 3 to 3 years sounds like a really nice guy. He liked all the weirdos of the world. He accepted them. That's beautiful. I think, but when we look at like maybe the Spanish Inquisition or the conquest and
That's another.
what humans did with this sort of beautiful concept is, again, that's another thing I look at constantly as humans. We're just fucked up.
Yeah. And Jesus was definitely not a white man, and he
definitely not.
And if he would be living today, he would certainly not. He would not live in Florida. I think he would live on a park bench somewhere, or underneath a bridge, or maybe in Palestine. I do not know where.
Yeah, I agree.
Are there any concerts now? You said that you will be soon going to the States, but are there any concerts coming up in the next few months?
Yeah. So what's going on right now, man, is basically, my last tour that I did was 2023. It was in Australia. And what I started realizing, because a lot of people don't know what I've been doing because I kind of been a little bit underground. I think what I started realizing is that because I was performing so much, surviving, I was killing my writing. And so what I've done is I've stopped performing to write an Augustine's record. That's the truth. I've not told anybody but you. And I have been working this entire time, and like in writing, and I've finished writing an album. I've written an Augustine's record, so it's worked. And so now, 2024, my job now is to figure out how to be a band, how to get back on the road, and how to do a rock and roll band again.
Super, super. I'm really super happy to hear that, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too, if it's possible. I hope it's possible.
Do you think that it would ever be possible that you would be touring here in Luxembourg, or the region around? It's Luxembourg is a very, very small country between Belgium, France, and Germany. I mean, should there be any gigs, or should there be interest, would you be able to come down to this country or to this region? Or do you?
I would love it. I think it's a better luck. I'll tell you, everything right now, like I said, I think the industry is completely, is so. I was just reading a British, I think it was the NME, and they were talking about, basically they're going now to Parliament and they're trying to talk to them about trying to make some reform, because they're starting to realize that they're losing the next generation of British talent. They're losing musicians because the clubs are closing. Mm-hmm. People are starting to see this is with Brexit. It's everything just got so complicated with COVID. The music world has taken such an amount of damage, and Britain's really starting to realize it. So and all my agents and label, that was always in the UK. So I think that everything now is speculative. So when you're looking at this, you're trying to look at, you're speculating, like, this is where I think the band can play. This is where we've always done well. This is going to be, try to gather some information and speculate on what can happen. And I think, I don't really know where we will be able to go. I know that we were a popular band, so I think that, we can get it. I don't know what people, it's really funny, man. It's like I've gone away for 6 years and I don't know who's even working in the industry that I used to work with. So it's going to be a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to try to put some of my independent thinking and my independent ethics into our band, because I think that I don't believe that the future is social media. I don't think that's really healthy. I don't think seeing 12-year-old girls doing TikTok dancing videos is really healthy for them. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's healthy for the world. I don't know why. There's no police for big tech. Yeah. Why are we not challenging them about ethically, what they're doing? We're giving humans cheap, free, and fast, and it's making everyone's attention get smaller. And it's a strange world. So it's going to be an adventure to see if this is even possible. But believe me, I love playing long concerts. I love our show. I love what we do live. So I'm going to be trying to play everywhere we can. I just don't know what I'm going to be walking into.
Billy McCarthy, I really believe you are a remarkable personality and an outstanding artist. Thank you. Thank you very, very much for this interview. I wish you all the best for your future, and I hope that we will meet again one day.
I share that with you. You've been a gentleman. I really appreciate your time.